Good morning and welcome to the last lecture on classical mechanics. And today I would like to do three things. So first, I would like to give you a flavor what a contact geometry is and how to include time dependence in the Hamiltonians. And it will just be a flavor, and if you are interested more in this, read Arnold's book. He has many more applications and many more nice things about this thing. Second, despite the fact that only two people haven't seen string, I thought this is so important that I'll review it anyway. And then if we have some time, I'll recapitulate what we have done in this course. So what we discussed yesterday was that we discussed Hamiltonians which could depend only on Q and P, but there was no time dependence. And we knew that the way to describe this was the symplectic geometry. And in particular, what it means is that you have even dimensional phase space, and dimensional manifold, and your symplectic two form, which is an antisymmetric closed two form, is non-degenerate, which means that really, as a matrix rank, it has 2n. So now our aim today is to include the time dependence. So we have now h as a function of qi, pi, and t. So we need 2n plus 1 dimensional space. And this is described by contact geometry. And you can think about it like a cousin or a sister of symplectic geometry, just one more dimension. So 2n plus 1 dimensions. And so now in 2n plus 1 dimensions, you cannot have non-degenerate 2 form, but you can have something which is called non-singular 2 form, which means this has only one 0 eigenvalue, while the other ones are not trivial. So omega is now non-singular, which means precisely one eigenvalue. Okay, and so then we called a contact geometry or contact manifold, a pair where you have m, 2m plus 1, and this omega, where this is closed as n non-singular. And that's a definition of a contact manifold. And so I had some remarks. The first remark was that really this is nothing else than an odd dimensional version of the symplectic geometry. And so remarks if I continue where I finished yesterday. So the second one, so first one was that it is just odd dimensional version of symplectic geometry. A second one is that you can introduce a one form, which is called contact one form. Contact one form theta. And so you construct your closed form omega as d. So omega now is d theta. Okay. So now this omega has precisely some null vector, precisely one null vector, if you don't care about its normalization, and that's called vortex or null direction. Vortex or null direction x, and that's given by x hook omega equals to 0. So it's precisely the direction of the 0 eigenvalue of your omega. And so mathematicians like this x so much that they give it a different name if it is normalized. So specifically, if theta x is equal to 1, so if x is normalized given the theta, then you call this a reap vector. So now is a beautiful branch of mathematics which studies so-called special Riemannian manifolds. It's just a remark here. In manifolds. And basically, they are nothing else than what you already know. It's basically like symplectic geometry and contact geometry, but your omega is now more restricted. So now you have a metric that means that that's the Riemannian manifold, and then you can restrict your omega a little bit more. And so the even dimensional version, the special manifolds are called Kähler manifolds. Kähler. And the odd dimensional version is called Sasaki manifold. So this is M is 2n, and then omega is called now called the Kähler 2 form. And in the Sasaki case, you have M to 2n plus 1, so that's like a contact geometry. And again, X is now called, in this context, a Riemann vector. And so because you have now manifold, you can do more things. So you're imposing more restrictions on your two-form omega. So for example, in the Kähler case, the restriction is that the covariant derivative on omega is equal to 0. Not only that it is closed, but also that the covariant derivative, which is given to you by the metric, is actually 0 as well. And you know, similar restriction on the Sasaki manifolds here. And so these manifolds play a very important role for the string theory, and you know, they are sort of like supersymmetric manifolds, and you compactify on these manifolds and so on. So these play a really important role, not only for mathematicians, but also for physics and string theory and stuff like that. So it was just to give you the words. Remark number 4. Well, we have this relation. So our null direction or vortex direction actually preserves the form omega. Of course, the proof is very simple. Again, you do the Cartan's lemma. So you have x d omega plus d x hook omega. And now both of these terms identically vanish, right? So this guy is 0 because omega is closed. And this guy is 0 because we have null direction. So that's a proof of this statement, which again is a very important statement because it tells you basically that if you associate your time evolution with a translation along this vector field X, as we did in the symplectic case, then actually this is a canonical transformation in some sense. It preserves the structure of your contact geometry, and it's a canonical transformation. Okay, so now perhaps the most important property is again the Darboux theorem for physics. So basically exactly in the same way as we had it for even dimensional case, so we know that omega is closed and non-singular. So then the statement is there exists such coordinates let me call them again QI, PI, and T. Absolutely no connection to what we are trying to do here. And in these coordinates, your omega takes a very special form. So if I write it in components, such that your omega alpha beta, and I hope the signs are consistent with what we did in the symplectic case. And again, it splits into the blocks 0, minus 1, 1, 0, another block, and so on. But then you have this extra one-dimensional space, and there must be a 0 here. So this is the extra 0, which corresponds to 2 and plus 1 direction. So this is, again, Q1, P1, P1, Q1, P1, and so on. This would be the time thing. Okay. And so this is called canonical form. And if you want to write it, if you want to write omega in these components, not just the components of omega, then omega has the form dpi wedge dqi. So exactly as in the symplectic case, and then you know the extra direction doesn't play any role, and your null direction has precisely this form here. Okay, so that's the Darboux theorem, and that's basically everything you need to know about contact geometry at this point. So let me now start revising the Hamilton's theory, Hamilton's mechanics. So now the Hamiltonian mechanics and so you start this again definition of what you mean by extended phase space. So definition, you now extend your phase space by including time, extended phase space. And this will have 2n+1 dimensions, and it is my tangent bundle times r, which r stands for time. And so the local coordinates on this will be, of course, my, if I use the Darboux theorem, qi, pi, and t. I'm not saying that I have omega here yet, but so the right direction should be, well, first I show that there is the corresponding omega, and then I can choose the coordinates so that this is true. But yeah, it's true in the canonical coordinates. Okay, so now you define your Hamiltonian on this extended phase space. And so a Hamiltonian, which is now a function of, you know, a function on this extended phase space. So it will be a function now of these things. So now this guy you can define a one form, which is a contact one form, a contact one form theta, which is what we had before, pi dqi. But now you also use your Hamiltonian and dt. So this is the extra piece which you can have in the odd dimensional case. Okay, so that's the extra piece here. Okay, and so why do you call this a contact one form? Is because if you take the omega d theta, you find omega, which is non-singular, closed, on the space. So then omega from here, you have that omega, which is d theta, and has the standard form in the first slots, dpi dqi minus dh wedge dt. And so this is your non-singular closed form. So now we know that this extended phase space is actually a contact manifold. Because we have now 2n+1 dimensional space, and we have our omega. Okay. So easy peasy. So now, of course, the next step would be to find, so given theta, I find omega. Given omega, I can find the corresponding null direction. And there'll be precisely one direction. And if I normalize it, I fix also the magnitude of that direction. And so you can show and do it yourself. It's just one line calculation that the vortex direction, which of course you call again the dynamical vector field, is the dynamical vector field. Is given by this thing, x is dh over dpj, d over dqj, and then minus dh over dqj, d over dpj, and then plus d over dt. So, of course, to verify this, all you have to do is take this omega, well, take hook of x to omega and show that it equals to zero. And I chosen some particular normalization. Okay, so this is your dynamical vector field. It comes from solving the that equation, x hook omega equals to zero. So your picture now looks like this. So you can include time as well. Let's say this one, q and p. And now I have some dynamical vector field x, which has the integral curves. And so these integral curves, let me call them again gamma. So now you can choose. So before, we were choosing the parameter t. Well, you'll do it again. But for the moment, let's just do some general parametrization by some different parameter tau at this point. Just, but it can be t as well, as long as this, you know, t is a good parameter. OK, so this is my integral curve. And of course, what it means is that I have gamma tau in my coordinates. It's just qi tau and pi tau and t of tau. That's my parametrization in these coordinates here. So now you may use the fact that x is a tangent vector to this gamma. And that means that the tangent vector, which you now define d over d tau, then this is just d qi over d tau d over d qi plus dpi over d tau d over dpi plus dt over d tau d over dt. Okay, so that means that x is my tangent vector to these curves gamma. Okay, very good. But I already know what x is because I solved for it by using the fact that it's actually a vortex direction of my omega, right? So comparing whatever I see for x over there with whatever I see for x over here, I can write down some relation. And so this relation actually simplifies if you choose now your parameter tau to be equal to t. So this choice of the parametrization simplifies this expression. So now this guy will be just q dot, this guy will be just p dot, and this is just 1. Okay? And then comparing this expression with that expression, I, surprise, surprise, I have dh over d pj. Again, I have j and I, but hopefully you will survive that. So then this is qi dot, qj dot. Comparing the first terms and comparing the second terms, I have th over dqj equals to minus bj dot, and that's it. And then this is 1 equals to 1. So you derive, again, the Hamilton's equations in this formalism. Okay, so now, of course, because X is my dynamical vector field, it tells me, you know, how the time evolves, how the motion really behaves in the phase space. So if you want time evolution of any function f, you just apply X on f. So time evolution of any function f is simply given by Lx of f. This is what you mean by you know, dragging the function f along the vector field x. And this is nothing else than x of f by the property of the Lie derivative. But if you look at x of f, which is this thing over here, and you use the Hamilton's equations, then you see then that this is just nothing else than the Poisson brackets as we defined them before in the canonical coordinates. But now we have this extra d over dt acting on f, so plus extra df over dt, df over dt. And so these are the Poisson brackets as before. So now you see that really, indeed, you get the full thing, including a potential dependence on time. Okay, isn't that beautiful? All right. So next, let me look at the canonical transformations as well, whether now we really get the full picture. And of course, as you might expect, it is so. So if you look at the canonical transformation, basically, I'm redoing everything as before, transformation. Okay, so again, the same thing. You define a transformation which now can depend on time. And then the same thing for pj, qi, pi, and t. You call it canonical. So definition, this is canonical if it preserves the structure of your two-form omega, which means if there exists now a new Hamiltonian H prime such that my omega, which was originally written in this form, minus dh and dt, so that was my original form, is now in the new coordinates written as d pi d qi minus dh prime dt. So this is a definition. And so as long as you can find such a function h prime that this is true, then you have a canonical transformation.
Does it also need to preserve theta?
Well, it's a good question. So here I am treating omega as more important. You will see that theta can actually change. Right? In the same way as we change theta by some differential of a generating function in the symplectic form, then you'll do it.
This is up to a total derivative.
Exactly, yeah, precisely. So as you will see, it's a good question. And this still doesn't work. So precisely, so you now you can have two different thetas. So one is written in this form, h dt, such that d theta is my omega. But you can have another one, and that doesn't have to be exactly the same thing as this one, pi d EQI minus h prime dt such that d theta tilde equals to omega. So if I take their difference as I did in the symplectic case, you know that d theta minus theta tilde equals to 0, which means that this thing is equal to df. So locally, at least locally, this must be true, and I must locally have a generating function which is responsible for my canonical transformation. Okay. And so choosing this f now as a function of small q, big q, and t possibly. So now I just write whatever that relation means. So theta is pi dqi minus h dt minus theta tilde is minus pi dqi plus h prime dt. And this is equal to df. So it's equal to df over dqi dqi plus df over d capital I qi dqi, and then plus df over dt dt, right? So this is the relation I have here. And now you want to compare the same terms again so that you immediately see that this guy has to be that guy. So we have a relation that small pi r df over dqi, and well, this thing must be that thing. So pi is minus df over dqi. And finally, dt is the most complicated because I have to collect three terms. So you see that h prime minus h is df over dt. And it's precisely the relations I have been claiming before if you have time-dependent things. So your Hamiltonian can change, and it's given by this df over dt. That's the difference between the two Hamiltonians. Questions? So the last thing I want to do happens all the time. Sorry for that. Well, let's put it in. It's really to give you a flavor what you are doing when you are constructing the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. I will not rederive the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, but I'll just tell you, you know, what you are really doing there. And so the idea is that if you look at the contact form we have chosen for our description, which is this pi dqi minus hdt, and if you look at the corresponding omega, which is dpi dqi and minus dh over dh wedge dt, and this is a really stupid choice in some sense. And so why is it a stupid choice? Is that we know from Darboux coordinates that if it's still here, it's here, so there we go. And then from this here. So you see that if you choose the Darboux coordinates in a clever way, then this should be my canonical form of omega, right? So this canonical form of omega has nothing to do with that one. Well, the last term there is a stupid choice. So you see that basically you know, doing a Hamilton-Jacobi theory, choosing h equal to 0 is a very natural choice. It corresponds to going from those coordinates here to the canonical coordinates of this sort, where h is automatically 0. Okay, so that's what Hamilton-Jacobi theory does. It's nothing else than just going to canonical coordinates of your form omega. Okay, so geometrical picture of Hamilton-Jacobi theory. And so the idea is really to go to the canonical coordinates. So let's go to canonical coordinates. Canonical coordinates of omega. So we have new coordinates, qi, and then pj and t, such that these are really the Darboux coordinates of my two-form omega. So in these coordinates, my omega simply takes this form, as I was writing over there, dpi, dqi, and my vortex field is just d over dt. It's precisely the statement here. Okay, so this is what you want to do. And then, so what's happening geometrically is that if you have your old coordinates, t, small q, and p, and your omega in that form, and so then your vector field, you know, make some strange moves in this extended phase space. So this is my gamma. And let's say I have some point q, p, and t here. And then I start at some point q0, p0, and t0. So then, you know, these are curved curves in this extended phase space. And so if you do this canonical transformation, and of course, it is up to you to show that this transformation is really canonical, that going from that form to this form, it's a canonical transformation. And for that, you need really to write down the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. But then the resulting picture is that you have t, let's say I don't change t, but okay, and then you have big Q and p. But now my curves are actually very nice. So now my curves are actually straight lines up here. Well, this is straight. Okay, so basically during your motion, what happens is that if you start with q0, p0, and t0, then as you evolve in time, you end up at the same q0, p0, and at t. Okay, so you have straight lines in your extended phase space. In other words, q is equal to a constant alpha, and p is equal to another constant minus beta. And these are precisely what you imposed when you were constructing Hamilton-Jacobi theory, right? And so this is the geometrical picture what you are doing. You are just straightening the lines. You are choosing such a combination of coordinates so that in new coordinates, your motion actually is only in time direction. It's trivial in the q and p directions, but it's only in time direction. And that's the idea of Hamilton-Jacobi theory. And so, of course, you have to show that this transformation is a canonical transformation. In other words, that it can be generated from some function. And then, surprise, this function, actually, in order this to be a generating function, it has to satisfy the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Okay, so this is generated by f equals to s, where this s satisfies ds over dt plus the Hamiltonian, and instead of p, I write q. Okay, and I'm not showing this, but you can read it in Arnold's book. So if you are interested, read it there. Okay, so contact geometry, in some sense, even more beautiful than symplectic geometry, because now we can allow for this time dependence. Of course, this is not very useful in most of the physical systems where you don't have time dependent Hamiltonians or whatever. So for most of the systems, the symplectic geometry is enough. For however, if you want this time dependence, this is another alternative. It's beautiful. Questions to this? All right, so basically we are done with mechanics. And so the last thing I really want to show you, and I know that most of you have seen this, but it's so important that you will use it in quantum field theory course in some sense, that I would like to do it anyway, so that everybody has the same page when you are starting your quantum field theory course. So that will be chapter 5 instead of conclusions or beyond conclusions. And so I want to show you an example of a field theory. So example how you go from classical mechanics to field theory. And this will be vibrations of string. And so what is really illuminating about this thing is that this is, you know, this is something people have been doing for 200 years, going from mechanics to continuum to field theory. But in more recent years, it's actually the opposite direction. So people don't believe anymore that actually the space-time is continuous. You know, various predictions of quantum gravity theories actually predict that it is not, that you have some, you know, minimal length present in your theory whatsoever. So now they try to discretize it again. Okay, so basically what we are doing now is the opposite of what is the new trends. So, you know, discrete system. And so let's be very concrete. So let's consider discrete system of n identical beats. Which are hanging on your string or on your rope. And so hanging on a rope, and then you want to take the continuum limit and as I say, you know, for 200 years people are going this direction, now people are going that direction. Okay, that's the progress in physics, right? So if I have discrete here, and I have continuum here, so then the picture looks like, in one case, you are measuring how the string, the vibrations of the string in the transverse direction. So let's say my string goes from 0 to A, and so in the rest, it will be just a line here. But if you displace it, if you play guitar or whatever, then let's say at some moment of time, it will look like this. And so in the discrete case, okay, so this would be the continuum case. So in the discrete case, I have some beats hanging on the string. Okay, and so let's say that the rest distance, well, the distance here, so we are doing only displacement in the transverse direction here. So the distance between the beats in that direction doesn't change, it, and it's L. And let's enumerate the beats. So let's put some labels. So this will be QJ at T, and this will be QJ plus 1 at T. OK. And of course, if you go the continuum things, you really get a string without beads, but of some uniform density of the mass. So you send the distance between the points, between the beads to zero, but then you have to have infinite number of them. Okay, so this is x and q of t, and then in this case, it will be just x. And then this is the picture again. But now if you want to talk about the beads here, then you have dx, because they are infinitesimally close. And then this is psi of t. And then this, I'll put a label, but then I'll use a derivative for this, so this is a stupid thing to do. So let's put a label here. So in the same way as I said, well, when I'm talking about the bead J, J's bead, I put a label J here, and then J plus one means I'm talking about this bead here. So if you put psi of x label, it means that you are talking about psi living at this x here. So okay, so it's an x, and this guy is a dx. So then this guy would be psi x plus dx, and so on. This is, so x here is just a label instead of this label j for a bead. Okay, and so what we are effectively doing is that we are changing this q j of t to psi x of t. So from something which is a trajectory, if you want, to something which is called field. Okay. And so you can really write this as psi of x of t, because now psi depends continuously on x and continuously on t. So then this is your field in the x direction. Okay. Questions to this setup? Everything is very simple. So now the next step is to really find, you know, so you can write down the Lagrangian for the first case, for the discrete case. And then the question is how this Lagrangian transforms into the continuum case. Yeah, the water really destroys these things. All right. So in the first case, in the discrete case, you can write the kinetic energy as, well, the kinetic energy is the sum of the energy of all these beads. So each of them is 1/2 mq dot square. And now we just sum over that. So in the first case, it's just 1/2 sum j equal to 1 to n beads mqj dot square. Then the potential energy of this thing is, well, is something which is called a string tension. And so, well, if you displace the string, you effectively make the string longer. And if it's longer, then you actually, you know, if the string has some tension, then you have to actually, you know, it costs energy to make, and that's the potential energy you are getting. So now, in the simplest case, if the tension is something, is that you get energy if you multiply it by delta of the length. And so this is precisely what's happening here. So you are doing this thing here. And so how you are making each of the segments. So let's say I'm in J case here and J plus 1 case here. And we know that this is distance L. And so you approximate the length of the string by this thing here. OK, so this is L, this is that. So now if you want to calculate how the length changes. So if it is in rest, it's just L, but now is this guy here. So delta L is just by Pythagoras' theorem, well, L square, and then plus qj plus 1 minus qj square, and then minus the original thing. Okay, so this is delta L j. Okay, so now you expand this, you treat this guy as small, and so as a result, you have just 1/2 L, and then qj plus 1 minus qj over L, and then square. So yeah, it's just expanding the square root and treating as the perturbation is small. Okay, so that means that this guy, I continue the equality sign, is just 1/2, and then L, and then sum over j equal to 1 to n, and then t qj plus 1 minus qj divided by L square. Okay, so this is what happens in the discrete case. Any questions to this? I think it's very simple, right? So now if you go to the continuum case, so the first, well, to get T kinetic is very simple. You just need to replace, well, as you are going, L goes to 0 and N goes to infinity, then basically are treating the mass of one bead to something like a density of the mass per the length of the string. Okay, so you know, going to a continuum limit, the T kinetic is now very intuitively given by 1/2. Now it's an integral from 0 to A, and then instead of M, I'm just writing the density of the mass dx, so this is like dm if you want, and then you have q dot square, but q I replace with psi, so it's psi dot square. Okay, so this is the kinetic term, and so similarly the potential term, which is written over here. So now you put this L into the measure, you send L to 0, which is like dx if you want. So you'll have something t, and this thing is obvious, becomes a derivative. But now this is a derivative with respect to x. Okay, so the result is 1/2 0 to a, and then t is still there, and then dx of psi square. So in other words, you can write down the Lagrangian, which is T kinetic minus the potential energy, and this is equal to 1/2 0 to A. Mu psi dot square, and then minus t dx psi square, and that's it, dx. So that's your Lagrangian. Your action is, of course, an integral. So S is an integral L dt. Okay, so now what people do is that now you have dt here, but you have dx here as well. So they put, people put them together, and whatever stands in front of that, so they call Lagrangian density. So they go from Lagrangian to Lagrangian density by simply, so you define this thing to be, so of course it's integral from t1 to t2. So now this is still here, d2, but then also you include this integral, so this is dt, and then from 0 to a dx, and then you define this thing to be a Lagrangian density. And of course, in our case, the Lagrangian density is a function of the field. It's a function of psi, but also of its derivatives. You see that it depends on psi dot, but also on the derivative with respect to x. So it depends on psi dot and dx of psi, and also on t, and also on x. Okay, so this is your definition of a Lagrangian density. You basically take everything what you integrate over out, and then what remains you call Lagrangian density. Okay, so the Lagrangian density, we can read this Lagrangian density by comparing it to whatever we have derived here to this definition. And then L is just 1 half mu psi dot square minus 1 half t dx psi square. Okay, so what we have done here is that we basically replaced the trajectories with the fields. So instead of q and q dot, I have now psi and psi dot. But now I changed also, so the trajectory depended on time. So now the field depends on time, but also on space. So this is instead of t, and this is instead of q, right? So and then I can have derivatives with respect to the t's, but now I can have derivative with respect to x as well. Okay, so that's that. Okay, so now what you want to impose is again the action principle. So everything is the same as in Lagrangian mechanics, but now you just have to impose the principle of least action. So you vary this delta s, set it equal to zero. And so before I do that, I just introduce the canonical momenta if you want. So let me denote PT to be DL over d psi dot. I call it T because now there's a dot here. And then PX, which is DL over d dx psi. And you can calculate what these things are, but it's not important at this point. Okay, so now we are imposing the action principle. So we are imposing delta s equals to zero. So let's calculate what delta s is. Okay, so now we have these two integrals, dt and integral over dx. And then we have to vary this L. So we have dL over d psi delta psi plus dL over d psi dot delta psi dot plus dL over d dx of psi delta dx of psi. Okay, so that's your action variation of the action. Well, I was clever to denote these things. So this guy is PT. This guy is PX. And if you look at our L, the L doesn't depend explicitly on psi. Okay, so L depends only on psi dot and psi. Derivative of psi is respect to x, but it doesn't. There is no psi in it. So this guy is zero. Okay. So now, of course, the variation delta, in the same way as it commuted with d over dt in the classical mechanics case, the variation delta has nothing to do with x either. It has only to do with you know, how the field changes at a given t and x, right? So now I can actually, you know, write this thing as, so this is delta of d psi over dt, but I can put the guy here. So for example, I have d over dt delta of psi, okay? And similarly here, so this is dx delta of psi. So now we integrate by parts exactly as you did before. So I integrate by parts with respect to t here, and I integrate by parts with respect to x to, there. And so the result is, so I hope the sign is correct, but anyway, dt and dx. So now what remains from my integral is just p dot t. So I shifted this derivative on here, p dot t, and then plus dx p of x. I shifted that derivative on x, and that's it. And then I have also the boundary terms. And so the boundary terms, in first case, I integrate in time, but in the second case, I integrate in x. So I'm killing, in one case, I'm killing the time integral, and the other case, I'm killing the x integral. So you have two terms. So if I killed the time integral, what remains is the x integral, and then you have pt delta psi at t1 and t2. That's the first boundary term. And then the second boundary term, t1 to t2, px delta psi 0a dt. Okay? So, yeah, that's what it is. Yes. Thank you so much for that. Delta psi is still here. Very good. So now if I'm inside, so this is from t1 to t2 and 0 to a. So if I'm inside, the variation of psi is arbitrary. So now we're imposing this guy equal to 0. But what it means is that in some sense, all these terms, which have nothing to do with each other, this is something what happens inside this interval, t1 and t2 and 0 and a. This is what happens well, at t1 and t2, but this is what happens, you know, at the ends, right, of my string. So all these things have to sort of vanish independently. By requiring that delta s is equal to 0, I have to vanish all of them independently. So then the first thing is this is true, and this is your Euler-Lagrange equation, if you want. And so you are getting Euler Lagrange equation is precisely this, p dot t plus dx px equals to 0. If you write it in terms of x, then of course you can calculate what this is. So pt, for example, here, you just partially differentiate L with respect to psi dot. Well, it's only the first term which depends on psi dot. So it's mu psi dot here, and if you want px here, then you differentiate the second term, and this is minus t dx of psi. Okay, so now if you plug it here, you are differentiating one more with respect to time, so you have mu psi double dot plus or minus t, and then dx dx of psi equals to 0. Or if you divide by mu, you have psi xx minus 1 over v square psi tt equals to 0, where you define the velocity v to be t over mu and square root of that. And that's your wave equation for your perturbations, which you have seen probably many times. Okay, so that's the Euler Lagrange equation. And so we dealt with the first term in the string. So now to deal with the second term, which has to be zero, so you can arrange that. So if you look at what happens in this bracket here, is that you are saying, well, maybe I impose PT delta psi at T1 equals to something, and delta psi PT at T2 equal to something. And so this is precisely like choosing the initial and final time condition. So you are fixing the string at the beginning at T equal to T1, and then you are fixing the string at the end, which is like fixing at T equal to T2. It's precisely analogous to what we have seen in the classical mechanics. So this is like initial conditions, initial and final condition. Final condition. And so you can satisfy that by, for example, saying that delta psi at T1 and everywhere is equal to zero. So I'm really fixing the string at initial time, and delta psi at T equal to T0 of x equals to zero. So this is the way how you deal with the second term. And you know, that's something very analogous to what you have seen already in classical mechanics. It's just an initial condition. Okay. So the last term, however, is interesting. It's new term because it has, you know, no analog for, you know, in classical mechanics. This is the last term, which is quite nice. And what it actually tells you is what's happening at all times at the end of the string. So you, in other words, you need to provide some boundary conditions. Not initial conditions, but boundary conditions. And that's what distinguishes the field theory. All right, so third term is interesting and basically describes the boundary conditions. So what you are really trying to do here is that you want that this bracket vanishes independently. So px delta psi from, so we have that px delta psi at 0 and a for all t, and then has to vanish. And so there are two most common possibilities how you can solve this. So one is called Dirichlet condition, and the other one is called Neumann condition. So Dirichlet. So you say that the endpoints are fixed. In other words, delta psi at A is delta psi at zero. So you are really, so if you have a string which is vibrating over here, you keep it here, you keep it here, and then it can vibrate in between while I fix the endpoints and I don't do anything over there. Okay, so endpoints are fixed. And you can write it in an equal way, which I, well, this is okay. So that as you evolve the psi at, you know, at the endpoint in time, then of course it doesn't evolve. Okay. So that's one set of conditions. But of course you can satisfy it also by setting the other term equal to zero at the endpoints. And that's called the Neumann condition. And that means that the endpoints are actually endpoints are free to move or free to move. And so we are imposing that px at a is equal to 0, and it's equal to px at 0. So you have really these two possibilities. Either this guy is 0, which is Dirichlet, or that guy is 0 at the endpoints, and then it's fine. Or you can write it in similar way here, that psi, now x derivative 0 is psi x derivative dx, sorry for that, dx psi is equal to 0 at a. Okay, so now this is all very nice. So really, you know, when you are doing the field theory and you're still imposing the same action principle, still delta s has to be equal to 0, but now you are getting a little bit more out of this. So you know that you are now getting not only your Euler-Lagrange equations, but you are also, so the initial conditions is simply so that your variational principle is well defined, but now you also can play with the boundary conditions. So there's something which is already encoded in your action principle. And sometimes people don't know that, yeah, the action principle actually knows about boundary conditions. So in order the action principle to be well specified, you have to say, you know, I'm doing this or I'm doing that, or these are the possibilities I can be doing. Okay? Of course, you can then have some weird combination of these things, maybe so that this guy vanishes, but that would be like an interesting case. So now, the string can exchange momentum with the surroundings. And so, in particular, if you have fixed endpoints, so really you have to hold the string fixed at this endpoint and that point. So now if you move that string here, you know that it exerts some force on your hand so that, you know, it remains fixed. So there is a momentum transfer into your hands in some sense. And if your hand is not too heavy, then it may happen that your hand starts moving because of the presence of the string. Okay? So in the case of Dirichlet conditions, there is an energy or momentum transfer. Momentum is in some sense not conserved. And so by holding the string, you are actually providing something here. So momentum can exchange, well, exchanges. So if your string is held, for example, is held by a wall, so it exchanges with the wall, for example. It's the wall. Okay. And it's not conserved, so really it can exert some force on your on the holder. And so this is nothing else than second string revolution. Is that people realize that actually, you know, once you have strings, relativist, of course, string theory is about relativistic strings, but it's very similar to what we are doing here. So now they realize, yeah, so if I actually impose Dirichlet conditions, it means that, you know, there must be an object which holds my string. So there must be the corresponding wall, which in string theory is called D-brain. D standing for Dirichlet, so D-brain. And so then they realize, yeah, maybe string theory is not only about strings, but it's also about some other objects, about these walls, which can actually hold my string at the place. So there are some other objects in string theory. And Davide will talk about this. So there are D-brains. And this is a prediction, you know, very classical prediction that there must be D-brains in the string theory. questions? So the last thing I want to say about the field theory here is that, of course, when you are writing this Euler-Lagrange equation for this concrete Lagrangian here, Lagrangian density L, what we are doing is precisely the same derivation as basically in classical mechanics, but now we allow that psi depends on more variables. So if you now do the relativistic field theory, then your action is actually written. So now in this case, we put dt out and dx out, right, and call the rest Lagrangian density. But now if you live in space-time, then you have dt, but then you have dx, dy, dz. Okay, so it's dt and then d3 of x, or as people write it, d4 of x. And then the rest is the Lagrangian density. And then it depends on your field psi. And it can depend on all of the derivatives of the psi dx, dx mu. And of course, it depends also on this x mu, which is just the label. Okay? So it depends on the field, on possibly all of its derivatives with respect to x. And then x is the space-time label, labeling my space-time. Okay. So, and then if you write down the Euler-Lagrange equations, which is, let's write them here because it's an important thing. So then the Euler-Lagrange equations for relativistic field theory is just dl over d psi. And then this minus come from the integration by parts, d over dx mu, and then dl over, and then partial dl over dx mu equals to zero. So you can derive this by repeating the same argument over there. And this is where your field theory course starts, so from these Euler-Lagrange equations. And you will study some basic fields, scalar fields you start with, and then you go more complicated.
Sorry?
Yeah. Thank you. I wrote something in between psi and L, and then I looked at it, and I thought, it looks more like L, so so let's correct it to L. But yes, so you are differentiating L with respect to its variable, and the variable is psi and the derivative of psi. Yeah, sorry for that. That was really stupid. OK, so it's, my L looks very similar to psi, so yeah. all right. So we have 3 minutes to conclude. So you can read some conclusions and comparison of what, you know, so of what we have done in classical mechanics. And so you have, in classical mechanics, you have Hamiltonian description, and I've shown you two descriptions, symplectic geometry description and the contact geometry description. And there's a comparison table, you know, how one translates to another. You can do the same thing, basically, also in Lagrangian mechanics. Also, although this is a little bit more ugly than in the Hamiltonian picture, but you know, just instead of working with the phase space, which is a cotangent bundle, you now work with a phase space, which is a tangent bundle. Okay, so now you have Q and Q dot. So now you have Q and N the velocity. So now L, is, the Lagrangian, is a function from the tangent bundle to real numbers instead of cotangent bundle. And then you can sort of play the same thing. The tangent bundle has, again, symplectic structure. You can define omega to be a which is a symplectic structure on this tangent bundle. And you can more or less do parallel with what we have done for Hamiltonian things. So again, this is compared in the table. And you can read more about this in the appendix. But the last thing really I want to say is that we not only discussed and reviewed classical mechanics, but we also, I gave you some very, very short introduction to differential geometry. And so we have seen one application of differential geometry, which was to classical mechanics, differential geometry. And it's probably application people are not, you know, so well aware of this. So it's application to classical mechanics. But it's beautiful application, right? It's symplectic and contact geometries are beautiful. Of course, now what you will see another application of differential geometry is to general relativity. And in some sense, all you'll be doing in general relativity is that, so when we are discussing classical mechanics, we had our form, two form omega, which was antisymmetric. So if you exchange alpha and beta, you have minus sign. And this was non-degenerate. Non-degenerate. And it satisfied d omega equals to zero. So that's what mechanics needs. So if you talk about GR, then you will know, or you already know, that the central object is the metric, which is now symmetric. So if you exchange alpha and beta, you have the same thing. So this is symmetric object. Again, it has to be non-degenerate. And instead of d omega equals to 0, satisfies a condition nabla on g equals to 0. So there's a parallel between GR and classical mechanics, if you want, very, very vague. But anyway, so it's just, you know, you will have the whole course on GR on this thing. There is another application to thermodynamics. And so this is even less known than the application to classical mechanics. And basically, the idea is that if you write down the first law, TdS minus PdV, so you see a differential, so you see a one form. If you put D on the right-hand side, then this is a contact one form. Okay, so this defines a contact one form. And then you can repeat the whole application of contact geometry, but now to thermodynamics. So this is also a beautiful subject, how to do that. Then, of course, then you have another application of differential geometry, and that is to gauge theories. And you will learn that probably in quantum field theory 2. So in gauge theories, what you will be talking about is that you will see that the field potentials, for example, like electrostatic potential phi, is nothing else than the connection on the fiber bundle of something. So gauge potential can be thought of as connection. So something which is connected with the metric, and you will learn in your GR course. But yeah, so differential geometry has gauge theories have beautiful description in terms of the differential geometry. And finally, of course, there's some applications to string theory and mathematical physics. String theory and mathematical physics. And so one example is that you can study these special Riemannian manifolds and, you know, what they mean for compactifications of string theory and stuff like that. So special manifolds, you can do your essay on them. For example, Tibra is interested in special manifolds, and he has some papers on that. So you may ask him about special manifolds. But of course, people also, faculty here, are interested in special manifolds. You will learn somewhere that actually, if you discuss your Dirac equation and you discuss the Clifford algebra, then that can be described. So either it can be described by ugly matrices, Dirac matrices, which are, of course, basis dependent, and they are really, really ugly. And you can have 101 representations of these things, and it's all ugly anyway. Or you can describe this in terms of differential forms. And so you don't need to talk about matrices at all, but everything is just differential forms. So Clifford algebra has a beautiful description, Clifford algebra, and you will learn about that if you don't know about it yet in your quantum field theory 1. So Clifford algebra has beautiful description in terms of differential forms. So I think you have lots of things to look forward to, and I wish you good luck with the other courses, and that's the end of the course.